Hello, this is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and welcome to Rolling Stone. We continue to read from the August edition of Rolling Stone magazine, and as always, we start out with random notes. Like Years in Rain, Ridley Scott films that left us entertained. From sword fights to androids to the Battle of Mogadishu, a ranking of movies that defined the past three decades. Number 10, G.I. Jane, 1997 release. This military drama is remembered as a film in which Demi Moore shaves her head, but it's a testament to the star's commitment, watching her do one-arm push-ups. Lines blur between the on-screen groundbreaker and the woman playing her. Number 9, Black Hawk Down, 2001 release. A military procedural shot like a disaster film. This takes on the Battle of Mogadishu, makes you feel like you've been dropped into an active combat zone. Number 8, American Gangster, 2007 release. Sir Ridley gave Denzel Washington one of his best roles in this drama about Frank Lucas, the Harlem kingpin who built an empire in the 1970s. That story would have been enough on its own, but the director also devotes screen time to Richie Roberts, played by Russell Crowe, the Newark, New Jersey detective who would eventually take Frank down. Number 7, The Counselor, 2013 release. This sleek neo-noir couldn't feel chillier or more brutal, but it looks like a million bucks has a hell of a cast, played by Brad Pitt, Javier Bardem, Penelope Cruz, and wears his 21st century nihilism on its custom-tailored sleeve, a vastly underrated gem. Number 6, The Duelist, 1977 release. How else but the clang of steel could Scott have kicked off his career? In his first film, he chronicles a grudge match of mounting absurdity, the tale of a French soldier, played by Keith Carradine, hounded by a fellow officer, played by Harvey Keitel, who keeps challenging to a fight to the death. Number 5, The Martian, 2015 release. There are jokes aplenty in this survival thriller in which Matt Damon's botanist gets stranded on Mars and has to figure out a way to science the shit out of his dilemma. Number 4, Gladiator, 2000 release. Scott restored our faith in the sword and sandal epic with his Oscar winner about a Roman general, played by Russell Crowe, in the gladiatorial arena. And yes, we were entertained. Number 3, Thelma Louise, 1994 release. It's the ending everyone talks about, a photo finish of outlaws putting the pedal to the metal, but that iconic parting shot is just the final note of the honky-tonk symphony Scott plays with this slick crowd pleaser about friends pushed over the line and on the lam by a sexist world. And number 2, Blade Runner, a 1982 release. Flesh and blood, or just good circuitry. Decades later, fans keep searching for clues to the true nature of Rick Deckard, the fashionably unknowable killer Harrison Ford plays in Scott's genre-redefining dystopian noir. And number 1, Alien, 1979 release. Ridley Scott's second movie is the ultimate haunted house in space story, featuring a revolutionary female hero in Sigourney Weaver's Ripley. And moving along in random notes, more film news, Ravenous. John Early and the Art of Sexy Food Content. The comedian tackles chief videos and his worst millennial urges in his new movie called Maddie's Secret. In 2020, while the world was reeling from a global pandemic, there was only one thing that kept John Early calm, the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, a content studio run by the venerated food magazine. The kitchen was a hallmark of internet optimism and a harbinger of the current pivot to video media model. It was a huge fixation of mine. I was watching in bed before going to sleep, not even to cook. Burley tells me on a bench in Manhattan's Stuyvesant Square Park. The comedian, age 38, best known for his role as the acerbic gay best friend Elliot Goss in HBO's Search Party, chose our meeting place to take advantage of the weather and to say goodbye to the neighborhood. He recently finished his run in the off-Broadway play What We Did Before Our Moth Days and spent the past several months living nearby. With the show ending, he's heading back to Los Angeles, which he says has made him spend the past 72 hours weeping uncontrollably on this very bench. I'm distracted by a never-ending line of ants that have fixated on the wooden slats beneath us. But Early is looking at the sky, describing a beautiful window during the pandemic. Those videos were very comforting to me. What shocked Early was how quickly the online food world ditched their calming content for a psychosexual hellscape. It's so pornographic, John Early says. There are low-angle videos of a girl emulsifying pasta. The sound is so sexual. The slapping of the meat and the scraping of the crispy rice. I just couldn't get away from a performance instinct. And with me, it always starts with an itch. Enter the film Maddie's Secret, Early's directorial debut, which follows a chef at Gur Maybe Test Kitchen, whose rising place in the food influencer world clashes with her lifelong struggle with bulimia. She's blonde, beautiful, and a walking stereotype of a naive ingenue. Also, she's played by Early himself. Maddie's Secret isn't a drag film, although Early had to don a blonde wig, breast prosthetics, and hip pads to take on the role. Instead, he plays Maddie, believably, as a woman as she's promoted from dishwasher to digital series regular. If the aggressive resurgence of her eating disorder isn't enough, she's also juggling her overbearing sapphic best friend, Dina, played by Kate Berlant, her coddling husband, Jake, played by Eric Rahill, and a fight to be the next food curator for the hit dramedy The Boar, an unsuitable parody of The Bear. But as the film continues, Early's earnestness blurs comedy and drama, leaving a surprisingly heartfelt story in its place. I tried to do this in the body of a gay guy, and this will absolutely say more about my own kind of internalized homophobia than anything else, but it felt caustic, John Early says. I feel a little more as an artist, maternal, a little gentler. And once I accepted that, all of this feeling and color and style and cinematic expressiveness rushed into the whole enterprise. It would be easier to call the film Maddie's Secret a campy comedy, but that would strip the film of its essence. Early says that the movie takes much of its aesthetics and emotional satire cues from director Paul Verhoeven's films Showgirls, released in 1995, and Starship Troopers, released in 1997. Which means the more disorientated people are, the better. I wanted people to be in a physical state where you've laughed so much, your lungs are open, and you're more ready to receive the emotion, he says. I'm proud I've made a movie that creates tonal confusion. But behind the absurdity is a serious story about bulimia. I was thinking about TV movies where there's an hysterical revelation of a secret, he says. If someone's passion is making food, an eating disorder would be the opposite of that. Still, he did his research. In addition to watching documentaries like the movie Thin, released in 2006, and reading the 1978 book, The Best Little Girl in the World, Early spoke to a close friend who went to an inpatient treatment center, which is where he got many of the real-world details, like Maddie and her other patients being required to sing while in the bathroom to make sure they weren't purging. Emmy Sedaris gifted him the 1982 Cherry Bone O'Neill memoir, Starving for Attention. She was like, tonally, it's all in here, Early says. It's a sensitive issue, but that's what most movies are for. Now, when you're making something, you almost have to prove your caution. I'm not trying to teach anyone anything. The reason why it maybe feels like it was dealt with sensitively is because I tried not to be sensitive. The film is a family affair, staffed almost entirely with John Early's close personal friends in comedy like Berlant and Vanessa Baer of Saturday Night Live, Connor O'Malley, I Think You Should Leave, and Kristen Johnston, Third Rock from the Sun. Not only did they film in Early's actual house, but the actor's ex-boyfriend, Gordon Landenberger, worked as the movie's production designer. "I'm always trying to hire my friends," Early says, "but I also want to work with people who, like me, the director, don't necessarily know what they're doing. If we're all pawing around in the dark a little bit, something potentially original could occur." There's a lot going on in Maddie's Secret. There's the critique of online food content. There's the exploration of the self-destructive nature of eating disorders. There's the thrilling single white female element gleefully displayed by Berlant. There are panic attacks and queer cardio classes and shot after shot of steaming, oozing, overflowing plates of food. But if the core of the film is the race for self-discovery, you may be hard-pressed to find someone who's learned more than John Early. I spent a lot of time in my stand-up, in interviews, and in the stuff I've made poking fun at the millennial thing, and I actually feel quite tired of it, he says. He adds, playing Maddie was both consciously and unconsciously a way of accepting that part of myself. So we leave Random Notes and we turn to National Affairs. Under fire, justice can't be a political force. James Comey, the former FBI director and now Trump target, sits for the National Affairs interview by Matt Bye. Whatever you think of James Comey, it's hard to argue with this. No unelected official this century has been at the center of so many high-stakes controversies in Washington, D.C., with so many serious consequences for the country. As Deputy Attorney General in the George W. Bush administration, James Comey squared off against Dick Cheney and senior White House aides over where to draw the line on warrantless wiretaps and secret torture. In 2016, as FBI director, Comey infuriated Democrats when he decided to give a press conference, lone wolf style, to announce that Hillary Clinton, then the Democratic nominee for president, had very likely broken the law by discussing classified work in her private emails, even though she wouldn't be charged. Months later, on the eve of that election, he notified Congress that the FBI had found yet more emails and would reopen its investigation into Clinton, a move that may very well have gotten Donald Trump elected. When Comey refused to pledge loyalty to Trump and dropped the investigation into Russian interference in the presidential election, Trump fired him. That, of course, ignited a long public feud that's made Comey, during Trump's second term, the president's number one target for retribution. Last September, Trump's Justice Department indicted Comey for lying to Congress about whether he authorized leaks related to the Russia probe, an indictment promptly tossed out by a federal court. Then in April, the administration charged Comey with threatening to kill the president because he posted a picture of menacing seashells he found on a beach arranged to look like 8647, as in, get rid of Trump. This latest indictment has about as much chance of surviving a day in court as I do of becoming Chief Justice. All this comes at a moment when Comey is trying to put political life behind him. Since 2023, he's been pursuing a new career as a prolific writer of legal thrillers in the Scott Turow vein. His latest novel, Red Verdict, is the first one he's written, featuring the fictional prosecutor Nora Carlton, who just happens to work in the same U.S. Attorney's office in Manhattan that Comey once led. It's also where his daughter, Maureen Comey, was a top prosecutor until Trump fired her, too. She's now suing the government. Comey's novels are surprisingly engrossing, largely because the fictional characters feel like the thin cover for his lived reality. Maybe the Justice Department will find a way to indict him for that as well. Comey and I were supposed to meet on the first day of May, but he delayed our interview at the last minute after finding out he is being reindicted for photographing the killer seashells. I was somewhat surprised when he rescheduled just a few weeks later with the stipulation that he wouldn't be able to discuss the details of that latest case. So we sat outdoors at the Old Anglers Inn, a historic roadside pub just across the Potomac River from his Virginia home. That was the first time I ever met James Comey. Over the years, I'd heard him described as both a closet Clinton hater and an avid never Trumper, and I've talked to plenty of lawyers and journalists who regard Comey as an operator and attention hound. Over the course of our 90-minute conversation, though, Comey didn't come across as any of these things. Arriving without handlers, relaxed in a polo and shades, he seemed comfortable with self-doubt and laughed easily. He gave no hint of evasion. I had the sense of him as a true believer in public service who saw his own duty as being above the realm of politics, but who had nonetheless worked his way into a series of jobs where factoring in the politics wasn't so much a character flaw as a requirement. It's not that Comey lacked the political radar to navigate at the highest level of government. It's more that his own self-image compelled him to ignore the signals. Comey and I talked about Trump, justice, fiction, and regrets. My first question. You spend your life in law enforcement, and then you wake up one day last September, and you've been indicted. Just walk me through what that's like. Comey? Yeah, that's a great question. I think it was disorientating. Probably less upsetting for me. And what I mean by that is I know the system. I know what courtrooms are like. I know what processing is like. I know the courts. But maybe in some ways that made it more disorientating to be at the wrong table. When I was sitting there with my lawyers, I really did have this sense of spatial disorientation. I'm at the wrong table. My team should be over there. So that's what I mean by disorientating. I had a little time. It wasn't a complete surprise because I heard in the media that they were coming after me. But yeah, that was my primary reaction. Disorientation, but not as freaked out as someone who doesn't know how the system might be. Question, do you think there was a way in which you could actually put your career or your freedom in jeopardy, Comey? No, I did not, never a doubt, ultimately because I fundamentally knew that I was innocent. And the question for me and my team was, so what will be the basis on which this will get dismissed before a trial? And I was keen to have it dismissed as a vindictive prosecution for other people's benefit. It's just too bad that it got dismissed on other grounds, because I thought it was important to establish that a president cannot do this, that you cannot target someone for speaking out, for standing up, and we didn't get to that point. I had complete faith how it was going to end up. Question. Now they have this new indictment involving the seashells. I've taken to calling it Jim C. Seashells Down by the Seashore. Comey, yeah, say that 5 times fast. Comey, I'm not the expert you are, but I'm not sure I've ever seen an indictment like this. There's nothing in it. Comey, yeah, I'm going to be careful because I promised my friends who are my lawyers that I won't talk about it, and I think it's important I abide by the court rules by not talking about it. But I always assumed, and I will assume it will continue. If not this, there'll be something else. Because Donald Trump has made clear to his personal lawyers who now lead the Justice Department that this is what he wants, so it didn't surprise me, and there'll be something else. Question, do you have to pay legal fees for all this, or are your lawyers doing you a favor? Comey, people are volunteering to be part of it, but I do have to pay. It costs me money, and I think for Trump, he intends that process to be part of the punishment. I'm lucky. Compared to a lot of people who've just done public service, that I've made, saved money. But in the main, they're contributing their time on my behalf. Question, do you regret taking photos of the seashells? Comey, I'm not going to answer that. Question, the acting Attorney General Todd Blanche came out in the wake of this indictment and said publicly, well, there's more evidence. That seemed particularly nefarious. I would think that as a prosecutor, you're not supposed to insinuate that you have more evidence about a person when you've had the opportunity to lay that evidence out, and there's no national security reason, I presume, why you can't do that. Did that strike you as particularly untoward? Comey, yeah. I think the most I can say in response to that is that it's important that all participants respect the court process and abide the local rules not to talk about evidence or legal arguments outside of the courtroom. And so I'm not going to do that. I think it's important that the government do that as well. Question. So big picture, what do you think the goal of all this really is about? It's not to put you in jail because no one could file that indictment and think they were going to actually succeed in doing so. What do you think is going on? Comey, I don't know for sure because it requires me to try to imagine myself inside Donald Trump's head. But I think his approach to me and to many others, including John Brennan, Jim Clapper, Adam Schiff, Letitia James, is I need to get even with people who have, in his view of the world, come after him, either criticized him or investigated him. And I also need to send a message to others that if you try to come after me, there'll be a significant cost. Question. What if you were a prosecutor tasked with bringing that kind of case on behalf of the president? What would you have done? You've been in that position. Comey. One of the most important speeches ever given in the Department of Justice history was by Robert Jackson, who was then the Attorney General and went on to be in the Supreme Court and become the Chief Nuremberg Prosecutor after World War II. But in 1940, as we're getting close to war, Jackson brought all of the federal prosecutors to the Justice Department, to the Great Hall there, and he gave this amazing speech about the role of a federal prosecutor because he was worried about these people. And he essentially said, prosecutors can be the most useful force in society, and they can be one of the most dangerous. And what marks the second from the first is picking a person instead of investigating a crime. And don't ever do that. Don't ever make decisions for partisan reasons. That speech kind of laid dormant in the Department of Justice lore. But in 1988, Anton Scalia cited it in a dissent from a case involving the independent counsel statute. And then everyone talked about that speech after that. I can remember hearing about that speech when I was an assistant U.S. attorney in New York in the late 80s. It had been given 48 years earlier. But since the late 80s, the Robert Jackson speech is, I don't know the right word, is the life force of the Department of Justice for both Republicans and Democrats. And so I would hope that if I were in a situation where a president I worked for was trying to get me to pursue a person in that way, I would remember that speech and either say no and be fired, or say no and resign, or maybe say no and convince a president that you shouldn't be acting that way. Question. It's like your Harrison Ford in the great scene from The Fugitive when he's standing on the edge of the cliff and shouts, I'm innocent. And Tommy Lee Jones says, I don't care. Comey, and then he jumps off of it. Question. It seems like they don't care. Comey. Yeah, I don't know who the they is. I'm sure there's all kinds of different feelings, but yeah, it doesn't seem to me like the leadership of the Department of Justice is living Robert Jackson's words. They've lost the plot. And that's really bad for lots of reasons, and it's important that even I not become numb to it. There's a danger in that, right? Oh, here comes another indictment. So all we have to resist becoming numb to it. And it's going to be really important for the next administration to fix that. That's something the Attorney General did after Watergate. Question, that's going to be hard. Comey, I don't think as hard as people think, though, because I mean there's a danger. I'm too optimistic, but I don't think so. I think people are going to pour back in. Question, provided people want to fix it, right? Because there's always a danger, particularly in our era, that the low road becomes the new normal, that each party wants to avail itself of the same opportunity to twist and torment the other. Comey, yeah, there's a risk of that race to the bottom. I don't think so here again, because we've done it once before. In a lot of ways, this era is similar to 50 years ago. I think there are enough people who see just how immoral and dumb it is to have the Justice Department operate as a partisan operation because the shoe will inevitably be put on the other foot. Everybody understands why we always depict our statutes of justice in blindfolds in this country, because it just can't work if you're looking at partisan allegiance, race, creed, wealth, those sorts of things. So those two things come together to give me confidence that it's not going to be another race to the bottom. Question, to be fair, your critics and critics of the previous administrations might say, why is this any more a politically motivated investigation than the Russia investigation? Plus, the stuff in the Steele dossier turned out not to be true. Didn't political investigations begin under other administrations too? Comey, mistakes were definitely made. People did things they shouldn't have done. But the whys were explored, and anyone who cares to understand could see that that's not the department or the FBI acting as a political force trying to accomplish a political goal. We managed to piss off both ends of the political spectrum by trying to do the right thing in the right way. So I get why people say that, but it requires them not to have looked at Inspector General reports and that sort of thing. Question, do people come up to you in public and express support or anger? Comey, yeah, because I'm a giraffe. I get recognized. Question, you're tall. Comey, yeah, it's ridiculous. Haters don't come up to me, and so I don't know how many there are out there. The people who speak to me are very supportive. Question, you clashed with people in the Bush administration over what you thought the law would tolerate and wouldn't tolerate. Could you have seen anything like this happening under that administration of George Bush? Comey, no, because what struck me about both George W. Bush and Barack Obama, who are the two other presidents I saw up close, is that they were institutionalists, and maybe they were hiding something from me, but George W. Bush, once I got a chance to talk to him alone, and Bob Mueller got a chance to talk to him alone, he wanted to know what the right answer was. And so I can't imagine the Department of Justice being used in the same way it's being used by Trump. Question, this has also affected your family. Your daughter, Maureen, was fired, and you have a son-in-law who resigned as the federal prosecutor after the first indictment of you. I would imagine that's one of the harder pieces of this whole experience. Comey, yeah, as a parent, you have to say to yourself, say whatever you want about me, but my children? Are you kidding me? And so, yeah, that was painful to see Maureen fired because she had the poor judgment to choose me as her father and my son-in-law having to give up his career that he loved. And so, yeah, that's painful. Question, can you sue the president for harassment? Comey, I don't know. It's a good question. I've seen now in the paper that there'll be commissions set up to reward money to people who are targeted by the Biden administration. So maybe there'll be another commission to hand out free money. Question, I assume you talk to people that are still in the agency or have knowledge about what's going on inside there. What are they feeling inside the FBI? Comey, my strong impression from talking to people is that the organization feels under siege, that they're shorthanded, that they're under tremendous pressure, and they're trying to hang on, and they're counting the days hoping they don't get fired or have to quit and can make it to the end of this administration. Question, do you know Kash Patel? Comey, no. Question, ever met him? Comey, no. Question, how would you assess his directorship? Comey, part of what I felt, and I know Bob Mueller felt this way as director of the FBI, is first of all, you're always on. Literally, you don't get vacation. You're always on in the sense that you're representing something and people are watching you all the time. So the way that you carry yourself, the way you dress, where you go, who you speak to, all those things are part of being the director of the FBI. And outside the United States, the identity of the Bureau is extraordinary. So you feel a sense of obligation to protect that. And if these stories are true, wow. Question, it seems like a generation of Americans are sort of being reminded of something we learned in the 1970s, that we have these organizations, the FBI chief among them, that can be turned into nefarious forces and can actually terrorize Americans or violate rights if used the wrong way. Comey, yeah, and it's a shame that circumstances force us to stare at that every so few generations, but it's essential. People used to tell me when I was director of the FBI, you seem like such a nice person, I trust you. And I would say, you shouldn't trust me. You should ask, how are you overseeing? After I was director for a couple of months, I called Bob Mueller, and we were talking about how it's going. And I said, you know what I'm stuck by is how much autonomy I have, that almost no one knows what I do. And Mueller said, yeah, no shit. That's why it's so important to have good people in that role. Question. Let's talk about the book Red Verdict, which is your fourth Nora Carlton novel. Was it always your ambition to write? Did you have in the back of your mind at some point, I'll sit down and write a bunch of novels? Comey, I never thought I would write fiction. After my first book, A Higher Loyalty, which came out in 2018, I wrote Saving Justice, which came out in January of 2021. And they were both story-driven books. And so my agents and editors started saying, have you ever thought about writing fiction? Because you write narrative well, you write dialogue well, you have a good eye for detail. And I said no. And the truth is, this is a stupid thing, but my initial reaction was, it's beneath me somehow. Come on, I'm a serious person. I don't write fiction or crime fiction, which is kind of a dick thing to think and say, and I was wrong. Question, it's an audacious move for any male fiction writer, much less a first-time fiction writer, to write a female character. Comey, yeah, I think it's fair to say I had a female-dominated household with more girls and boys, and I also knew that my first reader was my wife, who's always telling me, now, you're missing this, you're missing that. And then my other readers were the five kids who all read everything I did before I went out to my circle of friends, and I knew they would tell me. The beauty of my family is that they tell me it's great. I know they're not lying. Question. Some people could say that you're writing surprisingly woke books. You've got a gay woman protagonist and a lot of minority characters. Comey, I'm much cooler than I look. I've learned a lot about people's journeys of sexual identity from my own children. Question. Now, this being Rolling Stone magazine, I couldn't help but notice that you quoted a line from Empire Burlesque, the Bob Dylan album, and the line is, what looks large from a distance, close up, ain't never that big. Comey. Yeah, that's one of my favorite lines. Question. No one knows Empire Burlesque unless they're a true Bob Dylan fan. Question. Pardon me, Comey. I don't know much about Bob Dylan's work, but years ago I saw that line someplace and remembered it. That one stuck in my head. Question. There's another quote in the book that really jumped out at me. It said, as a lawyer on either side, you need to recognize that you could be wrong, that you could be making mistakes or misjudgments, that you may be blind to injustice because of your own biases. But a lot of people can't handle the cognitive dissonance that produces, so they suppress it under a layer of utter moral certainty. That's what a lot of your critics would say about you, right? If there's a persistent knock over the years in profiles or among your critics, is that you think your sense of right and wrong is keener and more essential than other people's. Comey, yeah, and I shrug. You can't see it on the tape. I've heard that many times. Nothing I can do about that. I mean, what am I going to do? Anyone who's worked closely with me knows that's not true, that I work really hard to doubt. And I believe, and I've long taught people, that doubt is not weakness. Doubt is wisdom. I've heard that a million times, that I'm self-righteous. And what am I going to do? Nothing. Question. Let me go back to the past for a moment. In your first memoir, you revisited the Hillary Clinton fiasco. You sort of decided that you did the right thing in difficult circumstances. You had a lot of time since then. Do you still believe that the news conference that you gave and the way you handled the Clinton thing in light of where the country's been especially was the right move? Comey, yes. And people ask me all kinds of time travel questions. I often say, so when I get to go back, what do I know? I'm saying that facetiously because it doesn't help me. Knowing what I knew then, by and large, they were still the right decisions. The only one I've sometimes wondered about is on October 28th, should I have dumped it on the Attorney General? Should I have just written a memo to the Attorney General saying, we can't conceal this, we just spent all summer, you included, Madam Attorney General, testifying that we were done with our investigation. Now we know we're not done in a way that the investigators say may change the result. You can't conceal that, and so you have to speak and tell Congress. You remember I tried to hand it to Attorney General Loretta Lynch, and by having my chief of staff call her chief of staff and saying, here's what I think he has to do, but he would welcome a conversation with her, the Attorney General. And the answer came back saying, she disagrees, but she does not wish to speak with me. I knew then what that was. That was, you take the hit. Question, this is when the information had been taken off Anthony Weiner's computer, and it was now clear that there were more emails you had to go through. Comey, all of a sudden, there were 300,000 of Hillary Clinton's emails on Anthony Weiner's laptop, and more important to the team was we can see BlackBerry.net emails, which were from the beginning of her tenure as Secretary of State, and we had never found any of those. And if there's going to be material evidence about her intent, which was at the core of this, where would it be? It would likely be at the beginning when someone said, you can't use your email for this kind of thing. So my team is telling me we have to reopen this investigation. Got hundreds of thousands of emails, got the BlackBerry emails. We don't know what they say because we haven't gotten a warrant yet. We can't review them before the election, and the result may change. And if you just spent all summer testifying, we're done, go away, we're done, and there's nothing here, go away, what do you do with that? And even as painful as it's been, with the benefit of hindsight, you can't conceal that. I mean, one of the norms that the FBI exists under is a duty of candor, especially when you testify. And so both doors lead to hell, but you couldn't choose the concealed door. The only thing I've asked myself is should I have just dumped it on her? Would have been better for me personally. And the final question for you personally, Comey, yeah. Write a memo that says, this isn't a close call, Madam Attorney General. You got to inform Congress that our testimony is incorrect. I thought about that at the moment, and I thought, well, that's a chicken shit way to operate. If this is what you believe, then you should take the hit, especially if she's refusing to talk to you. But it's been painful enough over the last 10 years that sometimes I fantasize about going back and writing the memo. And I probably still wouldn't do it because it still feels chicken shit to me. But yeah, there are plenty of people who are walking around, maybe even Secretary Clinton, thinking that I cost her the presidency. I was going into a CVS drugstore like 6 months ago, and a lady a little older than I walking out the other way, and she looked up at me and says, oh, you're the reason we have Donald Trump, and then walks past me. I'm like, well, good morning to you, lady. Question, well, let me ask you this. What if you did have a time machine and you could go back knowing everything you know now? We've had 10 years of Donald Trump, but maybe, just maybe, the election goes differently if you handle the inflection points of that year differently. Comey, obviously, as you think about what's happened to America over these 10 years, it requires probably more reflection than you might imagine. But look, one of my very best people was a woman named Tricia Anderson, and she was the Deputy General Counsel for National Security, and she asked the best question that I thought about many times since. When we were debating what to do in late October, Tricia Anderson said, should you consider that what you're about to do may help elect Donald Trump President of the United States? It kind of sucked the air out of the room. I said, first, Tricia, thank you. Thank you for that question. I'm so glad that I have an environment where someone's going to ask that question. But the answer has to be no, because down that path lies the death of the FBI as an independent institution. You can't have the FBI director picking out who's going to be president. Question, that's fair. Have you seen Hillary Clinton? Comey, no, I've never met Hillary Clinton. Question, you never met her? Comey, no, never. Question, you've written about the childhood trauma you had, the neighborhood rapist who held you and your brother captive. It seems to have been a defining moment in your life, as it would be for anyone. Is it something you still work through? Have you had therapy to deal with something like that? Comey, Yeah, that's a great question. My parents were, I think it's fair to say, classic sort of Irish Catholic. We joke and we move on people. I can remember my father waking me the day after this happened, shaking me awake to tell me that my brother was outside speaking to the media and I was going to miss all these interviews, so get up and get out there. He was being funny, but he was trying to find a way to deal with us. But mostly it was, don't acknowledge it. It was such a big deal. That was a Friday night, and Monday in school, all seven periods, every class I was in devoted entirely to me going to the front of the room and telling the story. Question, no way, Comey. All seven periods, math, science, and then I told the story over and over again throughout high school, and then I would tell it in college constantly, and my friend would have to tell me, truth be told, at a party we're hosting in a dorm when the girls were going to leave, get Comey to tell the story. But what I can now see happen to me is that it's not very healthy, that constant recalling, recounting, restoring, right? It's cognitive behavioral therapy. And I think it landed me in a much healthier place accidentally than I ever would have been otherwise. And so it's an important part of my life, but I've managed to reframe it as a gift to me in a lot of ways. And I mean, it did a couple of things, but most importantly, it made me realize how short life is, and it helped me. I don't know whether my brother has been able to process it in the same way. He seems healthy, but interestingly, we've never talked about how we processed it. Question, so what's your plan for the next 10 to 15 years? Do you want to write a dozen more books? Do you want to teach, do politics, Comey? Zero possibility ever. Yeah, that's not my thing. That I can say with high confidence. What I want to have at the center of my life is being a grandfather. Question, how many grandchildren do you have? 5, and I watch some of them at least 2 days a week, all day with my wife, and we return them after dinner to help my kids. And that is the most important thing I do, honestly. I think I'll write some more fiction, and I have in mind a nonfiction project. I heard another fiction author describe himself as a socially adept introvert, and that's what I am. So what I love about writing is, yeah, I can do it alone. I don't have to talk to other people. And so if I can interact with just my family and close friends and write, that'd be pretty cool. So that's what I'd really like to do for the rest of my life, to be a father, grandfather, and then do some writing because I enjoy doing it. Question, and stay out of jail? Comey, oh, and obviously stay out of jail. Question, I was struck reading your first memoir. You were still so optimistic about the future, and I felt the same at the time. This is what, 10 years ago, and your feeling was the system will hold, the institutions will hold, this country is weathered worse. And I wonder, are you still that optimistic? Comey, yeah, I am. It's been tested by the wisdom of the American people returning Donald Trump to the Oval Office, but I am. Because of probably a slightly darker influence than a more positive influence. The darker influence is I have a decent sense of American history and just how screwed up we've been so many times. And I'm always reminding people that I'm now a boring old guy, that the country was coming apart when I was a kid. The president was murdered, Dr. King was murdered, Malcolm X was murdered, president's brother was murdered, cities burned to the ground. Oh my God, America's over. No, it's not. And we've been through that journey a lot of times, and I think the rhythm of history tells me that America is going to be okay. And then secondly, I see in young people a passion that keeps me afloat. And so I really do think we're staring at a U-turn ahead. Question, I hope that's true. Increasingly, I feel like things are getting broken, that we've never tried to rebuild in terms of our place in the world, our leadership in the world, our moral example, our ethical aspirations. Yes, we've had violence. Yes, we've had downturns and injustice, but it feels like we're unleashing forces that are hard to reverse. Comey, yeah, maybe. Just trying to imagine the future that Donald Trump has just created with his blundering in the Persian Gulf, the knock-on effects of that. I don't know, but America will recover. I mean, at least in my time, we will recover. And I envy my daughter and son-in-law their opportunity to go back, because I won't go back, but to go back into government and be part of that rebuilding. It's going to be cool. And that ends the interview. You're tuned in to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you're listening to Rolling Stone. Well, we leave politics and we turn to music in reviews. The album by Olivia Rodrigo, You Seem Pretty Sad for a Girl So in Love, on the Geffen label. Olivia Rodrigo's messy, beautiful love story. The superstar's third album features even sharper storytelling, even more visceral emotions, and Robert Smith. Proust called love reciprocal torture. Bukowski said it was stranger than grass on fire, and Olivia Rodrigo admitted it was fucking embarrassing. Yet, on Drop Dead, the opening cut from her new album, here she is in free fall, heart on her sleeve, ready to risk everything as hope and possibility flicker over a magical night. Poets, philosophers, and past lessons be damned. The song is pure dopamine rush, built on heart-thudding percussion and glowing synths, the thrill of romance and anticipation ramping up with each euphoric line, kiss me and I might drop dead. This could well be the giddiest we've ever heard Rodrigo, who wasn't afraid to pack her blockbuster albums, Sour and Guts, with punky, pissed-off energy and wildly relatable, angst-filled anthems. For her third album release, it might have seemed like she was ready for a simpler, googie-eyed lover-girl era. Except, come on, we all know she's too witty, too self-aware, and just too talented a songwriter to go with rose-colored confessions about a new relationship. The title was one clue. You Seem Pretty Sad for a Girl So in Love. The title makes it clear that this project is a complex emotional ride, one that'll turn platitudes and presumptions about love on their head. There were cynic Easter eggs dotting Drop Dead, which is also the first single, like a reference to The Cure's Just Like Heaven and the hazy fuzz of guitars that she and longtime producer Dan Nigro went for, conjuring new wave gods and the image of a lonely-hearted Robert Smith, more on him in a bit. All it sets up something closer to real life is Rodrigo moves through the full arc of a relationship, the dreamy honeymoon phase, the first hints of conflict, the crushing goodbye, to achieve her most complete musically adventurous album yet. First, though, there are fireworks. The initial songs capture that feeling of falling in real time. Rodrigo has said the album is about her first adult relationship, likely actor Louis Partridge, whom she dated for more than a year. She's still on a high on the song Stupid Song, a track that feels like a blissful ballad before saturated 80s chords pipe in, but then anxieties build. And if there's something Rodrigo does well, it's to dive into her insecurities with a mix of humor and honesty. The seams come apart a little more with each track, a testament to how perfectly she and Nigro sequenced the project, capturing the downward spiral of the relationship. She's blindly hopeful on you plus me equals minus three, and even fully jealous on the song My Way. But the breaking point might be the stunning song Purple, where she realizes she's losing herself in her relationship. The balladry of The Cure and The Begged keep her turning the lens inward, though they threaten the momentum of the album. And if she needed to clarify her feelings more, help her eyes on the song What's Wrong With Me, when she's joined by The Cure frontman himself. Rodrigo has always proudly displayed her references drawn from 90s rock and riot girl bands like Hole and Babes in Toyland on past collections. But here she's doing more than paying homage. She's woven a sonic tapestry that any of her icons can fit into. Fans craving more aggressive pop-punk energy might have trouble getting into the new sound at first, but Smith's appearance is a testament to just how well it works. Rodrigo's storytelling has matured. For a girl who went stratospheric belting about teenage heartbreak on driver's license at 17, there's new wisdom as she comes to the brutal realization that you can love someone madly and still have to let them go. She lands on so many gutting lines, such as, if loving me means letting go and wishing me the best, then I guess I wish you love me less. She sings on the song Less. By the last track, Cigarette Smoke, she's found a kind of peace as she moves on. The memories turn dark, she repeats over and over. Maybe they eventually fade, but the songs stay with you. Olivia Rodrigo, you seem pretty sad for a girl so in love. 4.5 stars. And now we return to 50 Songs for 50 States. To honor America's 250th birthday, Rolling Stone picks a favorite song for every state in the Union. We left off last week with Florida, and now we move to Georgia. By Outkast in 1996. Outkast shifted hip-hop's focus from the coast to the Dirty South in the mid-90s with a sound steeped in their red clay roots. The Atlanta pride was there because we believe it, Andre 3000 later said of the Southern playlistic sound they perfected on Atlanta's, a silky smooth and deeply funky statement of pride in their home turf that put Georgia on the mind of every rap fan in the world. Honorable mention song, Ray Charles, Georgia on My Mind. Hawaii, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, What a Wonderful World, by Israel I.Z. Kamakalui, 1988. A beloved figure in the history of Hawaiian music and a proud advocate for Hawaiian rights, singer and ukulele player Israel I.Z. Kamakalui found international success with this beautiful, smiling, sung medley of Judy Garland's Somewhere Over the Rainbow and Louis Armstrong's Wonderful, Wonderful World, which he knocked out fooling around at the end of a 1988 recording session. The song was a global hit at the time. It's been a soundtrack staple for years. Honorable mention song, Bad Bunny, Lokela Pasa Hawaii. Next is Idaho, Twin Falls, Built to Spill, released in 1994. Usually musicians from smaller states tend to decamp to the nearest hip large city. In the case of Built to Spill's Doug Martz, that would have been Seattle or Portland, Oregon. But the Twin Falls native has stayed in Idaho for most of his adult life, recording 9 albums of indie rock guitar epics. This bittersweet ode to his hometown is a highlight of BTS's 1994 classic, There's Nothing Wrong with Love. Honorable mention song, Paul Revere and the Raiders, Humor Me, What's It Gonna Be? Next is Illinois, Chicago by Sufjan Stevens, released in 2006. In 2005, folk artist Sufjan Stevens released Illinois, a double album in which the land of Lincoln becomes a backdrop for a meditation on human frailty, American history, hope, faith, devotion, and loss. It peaks with the song Chicago, a sweeping song about found freedom and lost innocence on a coming-of-age road trip. Stevens' ability to evoke the hulking expanse of Chicago is up there with the novels of Theodore Dreiser and Saul Bellow. Honorable mention song, Cheap Trick, Surrender. Next is Indiana. Going back to Indiana, the Jackson 5, released in 1970, the Jackson family lived on 2300 Jackson Street in Gary, Indiana, before the Jackson 5 made the leap to Motown and took over the world. Going back to Indiana kicks off side two of the Jackson 5's 1970 LP third album with a high-energy blast of nostalgia driven by Michael's ebullient lead vocal. The following year, the Jacksons were returned home to play Gary West Side High School for a TV concert special, also titled Going Back to Indiana. Honorable mention song, John Cougar Mellencamp, Small Town. Next is Iowa, Song Iowa by Slipknot, released in 2001. The 9-masked new metal evildoers in Slipknot got together in Des Moines in the mid-90s. The local chamber of commerce isn't likely to put the Psycho Sludge title cut from the band's 2001 album, Iowa, on any local tourism ads. but visitors to the city can check out the Slaughterhouse, a haunted house inspired by the band. Honorable mention song, Tom T. Hall, It Sure Can Get Cold in Des Moines. Next up is Kansas, 2 week vacation by The Embarrassment, released in 1993. Wichita's The Embarrassment were one of the great Midwestern punk bands formed in 1979 with a killer psychedelic garage sound and self-deprecating hard chick look years ahead of its time. 2 week vacation is about a dude on a budget with time off from work and no idea what to do with it. They repeat, where can I go, what can I do, like it's a bored Midwestern mantra over guitars that buzz like pissed off crickets. Honorable mention, Kansas's Dust in the Wind. Next up is Kentucky, Coal Miner's Daughter by Loretta Lynn, released in 1970. I remember Daddy coming home in his hardbell cap. All you could see was the white of his eyes, Loretta Lynn recalled. He'd have coal dust all over him. I learned from it. She called on her memories of growing up, one of eight kids in a cabin on a hill in Butcher Hollow, Kentucky. Her daddy working in the Van Leer coal mines at night and farming corn in the day. Her mommy scrubbing clothes until her fingers bled. A number one country hit in 1970, it might be the greatest song ever about taking pride in where you're from. Honorable mention song, Bill Monroe's Blue Moon of Kentucky. Next up, Louisiana, Hey Pocky OA, The Meters, 1974 release. New Orleans musical ambassadors, The Meters, based this joyous 1974 song on a chant heard at Indian parades during Mardi Gras that means get out of our way, mixed in some second line swing, and gave it a jolt of funk. It's a highlight of their classic album, Rejuvenation, co-produced by Crescent City soul architect Alien Toussaint, himself a student of Fats Domino and Professor Longhair. You can hear all that history in The Meters' groove. Honorable mention song, Lil Wayne's La La La. Next up, Maine, Going to Maine by the Mountain Goats, released in 1993. Over the decades, John Darnell of the Mountain Goats has created a series of going to songs, desperate escape reveries like Going to Scotland and Going to Lebanon too. The people in Going to Maine are an adulterous couple running for Maine like it's a magical place where sins are washed and dreams reborn. For Darnell, who grew up in California, it kind of was, when I would think of Maine and like the whole, just the term, the East Coast, this was like Shangri-La. Honorable mention, Jackson Browne, Nothing But Time. Next up, Maryland, Silver Springs by Fleetwood Mac, 1976 release. This outtake from the Rumors album, arguably the most intense breakup song in the entire Fleetwood Mac catalog, rocketed to the top of the Fleetwood Mac canon after Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham's devastating performance of the song on their 1997 reunion tour. The inspiration came to Nicks when the Mac passed through Silver Spring, Maryland on tour in the 1970s. It sounded like a pretty fabulous place to me, she recalled. It's a whole symbolic thing of what Lindsey could have been to me. Honorable mention song, Nina Simone, Baltimore. Next up, Massachusetts, Roadrunner by the Modern Lovers, released in 1976. Jonathan Richman sings about driving down Route 128, America's technology highway, in love with suburban trees and suburban speed and the 50s rock and roll on his radio until he finally gives in to the magic and literally yells, I'm in love with Massachusetts. A student of the Velvet Underground who transplanted their urban guitar roar to New England, Richman showed much love for his hometown on the Modern Lovers' classic debut from the Museum of Fine Arts to the Government Center. Honorable mention song, The Bee Gees, Massachusetts. Well, we'll have to end it right there with the best song from Massachusetts and rack up this edition of Rolling Stone. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'll be back with you next week for the next edition of Rolling Stone. Thank you so much for listening.